We continue with answers to oral questions. We reconvene at question number 376, and the questioner is the Honourable E.J. Hillier.
Mr. Speaker, whereas the answer provided to question number 227 of 2017, can the Minister of the Court update the House in respect of the outcome relating to the selection of the Assistant Resources Manager that was a grade 4 post within the Gibraltar Sports and Leisure Authority?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Culture, the Media, Youth and Sport.
Mr. Speaker, the selection process was finalised and a successful candidate identified. This individual started her new post on the 1st of June 2017.
And Mr. Speaker, does it follow from there that there are now any vacancies arising within the Gibraltar Sports and Leisure Authority, or is it successful applicant and external applicant?
No, Mr. Speaker, the successful candidate is not from an external candidate, is within, and now it probably goes down the line as it usually does. But I must emphasize that the DSLA has not yet agreed up to the mining level. So if, as it goes down the line, because this is a managerial post, people within the organization will probably apply for these posts. And then we need to review the whole of the organization as possible.
Okay, Peter, can I use from that? In previous answers, some months ago, the Minister had mentioned that they were holding discussions with the sub-sides of the temperatures and so on. Is that process still ongoing and needs to be updated now in light of this vacancy? Or is the process now at its final conclusion stages?
The procedure is still ongoing.
Question number 377, the Honourable E.J. Hayes.
Can the Minister for Sport provide details of how many lockers are installed at the GSLA swimming pool and reveal how many are A, available for public use, B, currently awaiting repairs, C, assigned for use to just the members or any other entity, and all this together with details of terms and conditions for the use?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Culture, the Media, Youth and Sport.
Mr. Speaker, at present there are A, 152 lockers available for public use at the GSLA swimming pool. 110 of these are located in the accessible pool and 42 in the 25-meter pool. B, only 5 of these lockers are awaiting repairs and replacement locker units ordered. These are located in the accessible pool. C, no lockers are assigned for use to any entity.
Because now, I think the Honourable Minister, to give a look at the situation there, because I'm told by members of the public to go there that although the number of lockers was well in excess of 100, such as the Minister has confirmed today, that very few of them were actually available to use, hence leading to a sort of a hypothesis that they were either awaiting repairs or which is now being confirmed with only 5. And that none have been sort of assigned to that analysis, but we seem to be the same lockers are constantly from opening time to closing time unavailable. So something has gone wrong somewhere in the system. I don't know if the minister knows any sort of information at present, or we can commit himself to look into this as soon as possible.
Mr. Speaker, in relation to the lockers, the information that I have here obviously preempting the Honourable Member's documentary is that there seems to be people or the public that keep the key. And therefore, the problem is being looked at people get the seeds and take it home with them. And the problem, obviously, is that then you have, if you have 100 lockers, of which 90 people are going to look at and take the key, the availability is going to be only 10. But I can tell you the management is actively looking at a way in which people do, are not able to take the key, and also telling the people to bring back the key. Because another thing that they are actually doing is that they try and take the key, the lock off, and put new locks in. But again, the same thing happens. So it is a problem that the management is trying to sort out due to the people taking the key home.
I'm very grateful for that part of the answer. Yes, it does lead to sort of the city. Which is why I've ended my questions to the same, to get in details of terms and conditions for the youth. I'm sure one can deduct from there that the terms and conditions is that it's for day youth only, and the team will be informed. And I, rather than a question, I want to end up with an affinity minister who can come to my full corporation so that we can eradicate this abuse by what is today's phrase, the Kalaruga wanted for it.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Thank you, the Honourable Member. For that, even some of the lockers might, we were trying to solve the problem, and one solution would have been to pay a pound in which you keep the key and then get your pound back. But obviously, people were leaving the pound there. And keeping the whole locker for themselves. So, thank you for the Honourable Member for taking it with us, and we try to eradicate that Kalaruga.
And I dare to say, you and Mr. Speaker, we will do it.
Question number 378, the Honourable E.J. Phillips.
Speaker, can the government state the total cost for the taxpayer of the installation and maintenance of the solar panels that I've agreed at the Gatwick Hall?
Answer, the Honourable Minister for Culture, the Media, Youth and Sport.
Mr. Speaker, the Gatwick Pool has been under the GSLA management and known as the GSLA Swimming Pool Complex since April 2012. The total cost to the taxpayer for the installation of the solar panel system at the GSLA pool complex was $683,250.43. The maintenance contract for both systems is £68,000 per annum. The contract is held by Green Resources and entered into as part of the installation package. This is up for renewal in 2018. It is important to note that since the swimming pool complex has been utilizing solar panels, our cumulative savings on the electricity bill are currently at £270,339.13, with the fuel savings of approximately £75,000 per annum. Therefore, the total savings to date is approximately $720,000. Not only has it surpassed the capital expenditure, but it is also producing surplus electricity, which is fed back into the grid. And I haven't got anything, something prepared here, because the Honourable Member should also know that from the 683,000 odd that I told him, approximately £290,000 of those were EU funding.
Question number 379, the Honourable T.M. Hammond.
Mr. Speaker, I told this question some time ago, so if I may just rephrase it slightly because it is not quite on date anymore. And may I therefore Yeah, I think that, and so the answer should be the same. I just need to rephrase the question ever so slightly to make it make sense. So I would ask procedural propriety. I don't think it is possible for the Honourable Gentleman to change the question from the order paper. I appreciate that you may wish to seek to make it relevant, but I think for the purposes of the record, you must leave the question as it is on the order paper. And then perhaps the supplementary you may wish to clarify as to how matters that relate to the updating of the question. I'm happy to ask the question of this, and it doesn't require much explanation, Mr. Speaker. Can government say that it is the intention to raise the fine for illegal parking on 1st of April, and if so, by how much? And this is to clarify that the intention is, was it raised last 1st of April, which is not a reference to the next 1st of April?
The Minister needs to know that the record of Hampstead for question time is produced with the question read out and then the answer. So everything you have said will not likely be in the answer. If you want it to be the answer, I'm not saying that it shouldn't be the answer. It's very difficult to do that. He has to do it in the context of his first supplementary, because the answer, the question and answer is question, answer, and then the supplementary can do the clarification. Otherwise, what he said today just now, which he wants in the record, and I think it's absolutely right, it should be on the record, will not be on the record.
Mr. Speaker, fines for illegal parking were not raised on the 1st of April 2017.
I thank the Chief Minister for his advice, and just to clarify the question was before the 1st of April, and hence it was written in a different tense to the one that is now relevant.
Question number 318, the Honourable
T.M. Mr. Speaker, can the Minister say how many bus drivers work on supply to the bus companies and for how long they have been on supply?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Infrastructure and Transport.
Mr. Speaker, I will answer this question together with question 381.
Question number 381, the Honourable T.M. Hammond.
Do supply drivers to the bus company enjoy the same terms and conditions as full-time drivers, and if not, can the Minister explain how these terms and conditions differ?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Infrastructure and Planning.
Mr. Speaker, as far as our bus company goes, three drivers have been taken on as from the 14th of June 2017 to work on a supply basis. These drivers are only called as and when required and do not enjoy any of the terms and conditions of a full-time driver. At the present, there are no other drivers on the payroll that work on a supply basis.
Question number 382, the Honourable T.M.
Mr. Speaker, can the Minister clarify what special provisions will apply within the environmental zones as described in the Sustainable Transport, Traffic and Parking Service?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Infrastructure and Planning.
Mr. Speaker, the environmental zone should not be considered as a stand-alone project, but rather be viewed as an overall objective of the SPCP, which is to improve the current traffic transport and parking situation and encourage behavioural change and assist in modal transport towards more sustainable alternatives which will be better for the environment. An environmental zone can be considered as a low emission zone aimed at improving air quality. The manner in which this can be achieved is by the control of parking within the zone and also by improving traffic flow within these areas so as to reduce congestion. The control of parking looks at, where possible, the location parking outside the zone so as to encourage less vehicles to enter the zone, coupled with the redesignation of parking facilities to accommodate essential parking by the introduction of paying display parking. Other measures which are being considered include making access to areas within environmental zones limited to commercial vehicles and/or permit holders only. An example of this is what has recently been introduced in Main Street, whereby access has been restricted to fewer hours and special loading and unloading hubs have been provided within the close proximity of Main Street, thus reducing vehicular movement in the center of town. In addition to these measures, the environmental zones will be complemented by improved pedestrian access to the zone and by enhancing public transport links.
Question number 383, the Honourable E.J. Phillips.
Mr. Speaker, can the government confirm what further specific traffic measures it will introduce in the area of Governor's Lane with the book legislated to curb speeding?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Infrastructure and Transport.
Mr. Speaker, at this moment in time, the government cannot be categorical on what traffic measures will be introduced to curb speeding at Governor's Lane. The width of this road and the restricted access by the devoted bookshop makes identifying a solution challenging when trying to balance pedestrian safety and continued traffic flow in the area. As part of the SPPP, a number of options are currently being developed for consideration by the Traffic Commission, and once a full assessment has been completed, a decision will be taken.
Question number 384, the Honourable Ms. M.D. Hassan Nyan.
Who is responsible for the upkeep and maintenance of the Ready Bike scheme?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Infrastructure and Planning.
Mr. Speaker, the upkeep and maintenance of the Ready Bike scheme is carried out under contract by Gibraltar Parking Management Services Limited.
Mr. Speaker, could the Honourable Minister say whether this contract went out to tender?
Mr. Speaker, the actual cost involved in the Ready Bike scheme was actually funded by a private company. It was done with Gibraltar. Okay? The actual part of the maintenance that was in addition to the contract held by the company that does parking management. It's part of the same company to the CMA. So the contractor that deals with parking management, okay, like you know, they have this as part of the other contract. It's no different to them. And that went out to tender in two courts. That was the other two courts just in the region.
I'm sorry, I'm a little bit confused. Because it was privately funded, there was some sort of agreement with the parking company that they would then get the contract for the maintenance.
So there are two stages, if you have already completed. The launch of the scheme, the funding of the scheme, is not something the government is paid for. It's been paid for through sponsorship. There was an announcement that the details are paid for. The maintenance of the scheme is something that was included in the three quotes that were sought. Generally in relation to parking. So the parking scheme, the enforcement of parking scheme, which was run by this company before the parking, etc., was the subject of three quotes sought from the companies that could do that sort of work,
and that included the maintenance of the ready bike. So there was a competitive process in respect of this, as part of that general traffic parking maintenance contract.
Simple point of clarification. Can we even confirm that the water parking management services limited is not owned or controlled by the government, it's an independent third party private company?
So, Mr. Spiegel, I'm going to have a specific quote for myself.
Question number 322, the Honourable T.M. Hammond.
Mr. Speaker, can government confirm that the Eastside Range power generator is still serviceable and whether it has suffered any period of unserviceability in the last 6 months?
I answer the Honourable the Minister for the Environment, Energy, Climate Change and Education.
Mr. Speaker, I will answer this question together with question 323.
Question number 323, the Honourable T.M. Hammond.
What has been the average monthly output and peak output of the Eastside Wave Generator since October 2016?
Answer the Honourable Minister for the Environment, Energy, Climate Change and Education.
As a speaker, the Eastside Wave Power Generator recently suffered several months of unserviceability due to repairs and modifications undertaken following the severe weather experienced on the 29th September last year and subsequent storms. It is currently serviceable. Its average monthly output since October 2016 is 40.2 kilowatt hours, peak output 4.5 kilowatt hours.
Can the Minister please advise from the 29th of September, was it one single long-term outage until it became serviceable, or were there several short-term outages in that period?
Mr. Speaker, I think we must remember that this is not a government facility, it is EcoWay that runs it, but I am able to facilitate information. It was out of action due to storm damage from the 29th of September to the 5th of October. You will recall that there's been a lot of bad weather over the winter period right into the spring. It was also up carrying, and there were modifications being carried out of it, and that took a number of months from the 28th of October to the 2nd of February. From the 2nd of February, it was working partially, as we were monitoring how the modifications were going, and the modifications were completed by the end of March.
I do thank the Minister for the answer. I do recognise it's a private project, of course, but it is a private project which is very much been supported by government when it was initially launched. And I do wonder whether these expensive outages have given the government made the government consider whether wave technology of this nature is in the best interest of the group in terms of long-term renewable energy strategy, or whether other forms of renewable energy might be exploited, bearing in mind we have a six-month period, we have about 5 months with the system either unserviceable or being upgraded.
Mr. Speaker, any renewable energy, the use of the word in the interest of is a curious one. Any renewable energy is in the interest of the growth and of everybody else on the planet, needless to say, no matter how it is. I think you must remember that this is a prototype, it's a new design, and the government is very pleased to offer Devoto as a location for this
innovative form of power generation. And like every kind of scheme, people will learn from the difficulties they experience. They have learned, they have changed. In fact, only yesterday there was an announcement of a very similar plant being opened very soon in Mexico, using the example that the Volta has given, because they've been able to modify the metamorphosis. So because it was minimal investment from the government, I think all we did was throw the cable down the hill to connect it. It was all done at the expense of EcoWave. I think it's certainly worth allowing that to continue. Hopefully, they will be able to refine the technology, and this will then be producing a lot more power for Gibraltar and using the lessons learned elsewhere in the world.
Question number 324, the Honourable Ellis Young. Answer the Honourable Minister for the Environment, Energy, Climate Change and Education.
Mr. Speaker, I will answer this question together with questions 325 and 326.
Question number 325, the Honourable Ellis Young.
To the Speaker, the government will start to have any knowledge when Canada's last lookout has planned to move for the cable towers from the stone glass walkway of the substation.
Question number 326, the Honourable Ellis Young.
To the Speaker, has the government made any progress in updating or launching a new Applewatch mobile app?
Answer the Honourable Minister for the Environment, Energy, Climate Change and Education.
Mr. Speaker, the weather affected this again by severe weather, and the completion date is further delayed. The works are very near complete and are awaiting other works in the area to ensure safety. I will not at this time commit to a date. The final cost will be available once the project is completed. The sidewalk was tabled and discussed publicly at the Development and Planning Commission, where the public had the opportunity to comment. And finally, the app has been completed and will be released to coincide with the opening of the sidewalk.
Can the Minister just confirm that the delay has been clearly attributed to the weather and there haven't been any other factors which have contributed to the delay?
Mr. Speaker, I believe one consignment of glass was found to be defective and had to be replaced at the cost of the company producing it. That is the only reason that I know that there may have been a little bit more of a delay. And also, obviously, when working in an area which is quite busy, things like putting up the crane and removing it had to be timed so that there wasn't a cruise liner and so on and forth. But the main reason is certainly the weather.
Question?
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I'm not sure I heard the Minister correctly, but did he give an answer to question 225 in terms of supporting the knowledge, especially the cable car previously? He said he was mentioning DP3, but in terms of the consulting knowledge of the cable car before you did your own glass walkway, was there any knowledge or consultation beforehand?
No. The answer I gave, in fact, says that we, obviously anybody, including the cable car, could have commented. No, certainly we had no knowledge that the cable car was climbing. We don't even know whether it was climbing or they just thought it was a good idea and I wanted to have one too. No.
Question number 327, the Honourable Ellis Jones.
Mr. Speaker, can the government provide details of the electrical and sand work being carried out at the monthly stage, including cost, compressor, base work, and base work completed, and details of the work?
Answer the Honourable Minister for the Environment, Energy, Climate Change and Education.
Mr. Speaker, the PA system work consists of 16 speakers, 3 amplifiers, cabling, 2 microphones, and stand, rack, and labour.
also included a 12-month maintenance attendance and warranty, which will be effective in the current financial year 2017-18. Works were approved and started on the 9th of December 2016 and finished on the 24th of March 2017. Works were carried out by Sound Reinforcement Systems Limited. The work cost was £19,975.34 and the maintenance is £975 a year.
I would ask for the Minister, it is difficult to pinpoint whether I'm asking the correct question or not, being that I don't know what the cable is asked for. But there seems to be a lot of cable that's sold around the stairways in the space. Some are in conduits, others are just open, and I'm not sure if they're electrical some. Perhaps the maintenance would be able to know whether these are the works we've quoted or could they be other works with the penalty that we've seen that is a judge which I've got another there or it hasn't been finished or it's been a bad workmanship in terms of crops.
Mr. Speaker, the honourable member wanted to know what the cables were. He could have asked me directly and I would have found out. I don't know. My information is that the work is finished on the 24th of March, therefore I can only assume that these are other cables. I will certainly find out, but I don't have that information here.
Question number 328, the Honourable Ellison.
Mr. Speaker, what modifications do you say Martin School and early days in this year are being carried out? Or being planned in preparation for December 2017?
Answer the Honourable Minister for the Environment, Energy, Climate Change and Education.
Mr. Speaker, I will answer this question together with questions 329, 330, and 331.
Question number 329, the Honourable Ellis.
Mr. Speaker, what is the projected number of students expected to be at early days next year for each academic year in 2017 and 2018-19?
Question number 330, the Honourable Ellison.
Mr. Speaker, what is the projected number of students expected to be at the Martin School for each of the academic years in 2017-18 and 2018-19?
Question number 331, the Honourable Ellis Young.
Mr. Speaker, following on from last year's budget speech, what arrangements have been made to replace the old bus of the Martin School?
Answer the Honourable Minister for the Environment, Energy, Climate Change and Education.
Mr. Speaker, St. Martin's School is expecting an increase in pupil numbers in September 2017. Modifications are therefore focused on providing temporary, additional, and appropriate classroom space. Plans for this include the installation of new specialist toilet facilities along the same lines as was provided last academic year. This is an interim measure as the development of St. Martin's new school is a priority for government. The projected number of students expected to be at early birth nursery for each academic year in 2017-18 and 2018-19 is as follows. Academic year 2017-18, 17 students. Academic year 2018-19, 16 students. The projected number of students expected to be at St. Martin's School for each academic year in 2017-18 and 2018-19 is as follows. Academic year 2017-18, 49. Academic year 2018-19, 53. A generous provision has been earmarked specifically for a new bus for St. Martin's School. Details will be disclosed during the course of the budget debate.
Mr. Speaker, I'd just like to ask one for commentary. Therefore, the course of cabinet is being placed in the top of the AI study budget for credit administration or is it for classroom facilities?
Mr. Speaker, specifically which quarter cabin is referring to? There are several
in the site.
I believe it's the one where the bus is used for the 3.7 just so as is our own medium system in the main entrance.
The port-a-cart cabin at that level, I believe, is the toilet facility.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Would it be nice to be able to tell how many port-a-cabins are currently in use in Moscow?
No, Mr. Speaker. Had I had notice of the question, I would certainly have been very happy to provide it. But as I said earlier in my question, the variance in measures of the marketing school is a priority for the Parliament, unlike the opposition who specifically said they would not build a new St. Martin School during the last election campaign.
Thank you, Speaker. I know I'm picking up on this as a supplementary because I received a question from a constituent about these port-a-cart cabins saying that it was chaos when dropping kids off, especially on rainy days, to quote. Can I know when this interim situation will be alleviated, when the parents will see the difference, please?
Mr. Speaker, I had the same representation made me some time ago, not just in relation to the sports cabin, but in respect to the design of the marketing that it is today, how it has outgrown the purpose for which it was built in the 1970s, at the time it was built, St. Martin's was of the standards required in the United Kingdom for special students like the ones that we have there. And that is what led the government to make the decision that we had to build a new St. Martin's. And so, Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Lady will be delighted to hear that during the lifetime of this Parliament, those concerns that were raised with me at the end of the lifetime of the last Parliament will have been entirely alleviated. And the reason for writing is because this is an important issue that the Honourable Minister for Education is dealing with the Deputy Chief Minister and with myself, and an announcement will be made which will clarify how we intend to deal with those and other issues as soon as we are able to, but in good time to ensure that the solution is in place in respect of that and other aspects affecting the linked educational establishment in the lifetime of the Parliament.
Question number 332, the Honourable E.J. Phillips.
Can the government state the total number of teachers who have completed continuing professional development courses since December 2011?
I for the Honourable Minister for the Environment, Energy, Climate Change and Education.
Mr. Speaker, all our teachers undergo continuing professional development from the moment they start their teaching careers.
Mr. Speaker, I'm so sorry. The Minister has confirmed that all teachers have completed CPD courses, all teachers in Gibraltar have completed since December 2011. All teachers. Courses.
Mr. Speaker, the question was not courses, or the many of them do, both in Gibraltar and outside. The continuous professional development, and I know this myself as a chartered biologist, I have to continue undergoing this, has different types. There is the formal course element, and there is the work or in-service course element. And therefore, all teachers have undergone continuing professional development, and all of us who now have been parents or grandparents know those days off that the children have with down to in-service training. That is part of the CPD that teachers undertake. And there are also regular courses. People come sometimes from the UK in more specialist areas like special needs and so on. Teachers will go to the UK for courses. So I am very happy to say that all our teachers carry out this continuous professional development.
Question number 333, the Honourable.
I write as somebody who really doesn't know anything about CPD, specifically for teachers. I know about CPD for lawyers. I mean, I have a practice certificate in England, and I do my CPD there. It's not a requirement for Gibraltar. But listening to the Honourable Gentleman, did strike a chord, because CPD for lawyers in England, there are two types. You can, for example, undertake lectures yourself, and that would count as your points in terms of your CPD. But for lawyers, for example, you can't just simply do all your points with lectures that you yourself do. You've got to go and do courses. So there is a mixture of both or just courses. And I just wonder what the position is in relation to CPD.
I'm very familiar with that. Again, in my own professional life, I have had to do both. I was instrumental in bringing in formal CPD for doctors during my time as Minister for Health. In the case of teachers, they do undergo their courses, but not all of them are in the UK. In service training, there's a whole program of professional work that is done there. And these are lectures by different members of the profession, by other professors from other areas, and that is all part of the continued professional development provided by the teachers.
Question number 333, the Honourable E.J. Phillips.
Can the government state what specific measures the Department of Education has put in place to ensure all teachers and support staff are able to deal with significant change in the GCSE grading system and relations from the United Kingdom?
Answer the Honourable Minister for the Environment, Energy, Climate Change and Education.
Mr. Speaker, the changes to the grading system are not significant. This year, assessment for GCSE English and Mathematics will be reported using numbers from 1 to 9 as opposed to letters. A level 9 represents a super A star, only accessible to a very small number of people, as an example.
Mr. Speaker, insofar as the statement that they are not significant, I hope that you disagree actually with that analysis, but one of my questions I'd like to put to the Minister is that the teachers' unions in the United Kingdom have expressed huge uncertainty given the significant changes that have taken place in relation to the GCSE grading system. And I would have thought we might have asked the Minister to express his state of the government's view on this, but it's quite clear that the change in the system, which I understand will be piecemeal from English language now and mathematics to other subjects until 2019, and that significant problems have been identified in respect to the pressure that would occur in relation to students. And the unions in the United Kingdom have expressed their deep concerns regarding the grading system. I wonder whether the government is aware of those concerns and whether the union has raised them here with them directly, and what measures the government is intending to put in place to alleviate any issues that have been on students.
I think what we differ is that the main challenges and where the changes are most significant is in the content of the GCSE rather than the grading. And essentially, they have become harder both in breadth and depth of study. And that is where the main concern has been. And that is something that I have spoken to students directly about their concerns. But the team of advisors and senior management in school are confident that they have been able to deliver. Through the year, UK lectures have delivered in-service training to staff, and senior managers have travelled to UK and attended conferences and then fed back to teachers in order to be able to deal with this. There is therefore no reason to worry about these changes, but it is true that our results will probably suffer a slight dip in line with what UK results are expected to suffer as a result of these changes. And in fact, these changes have been designed specifically to achieve this. That is, I think, where the problem lies. I think that our teachers and the students have dealt with this magnificently this year, and in fact attended exam days in both Westside and Bayside, and seen it for myself. But it is likely, as in the whole of the UK, that there will be a slight dip in the grades. And that won't be a reflection on the teaching of the students, it will be a reflection on the changes to the content of the GCSE.
We should, of course, congratulate the teachers for the sterling work they're doing to deal with the issues of the grading system changes in the United Kingdom. But what I would say, in respect of in relation to this point, that English is being taught as a language now, being assigned to go to English, and a substantial amount of material is now being put to these students. And one of the questions that I had, stemming from this question, is to what extent of our teachers have been have gone on courses in relation to that particular point on English language, because the material is now being much more expensive, the exams are a lot harder, and as the Minister has indicated, that there will be a dip in the results that is to be expected in the circumstances.
Yes, I'm confident that the training that I mentioned earlier will be sufficient, and that the results will probably be much better even than you think they will be. If I may just comment, having attended the Bayside and Westside during a month exam, a GCSE exam, and an English GCSE exam, I asked afterwards to be sent copies of the papers, because I wondered whether 40 years later, 40 or more years later, 45 years later, I would still pass. I must say that having a look at those papers, I thought I might struggle with the English one, but I passed the math one. The fact that the speaker of the math teacher may in fact be related to that. So thank you, Mr. Speaker, for those days in the old grammar school.
I declare this to him, Mr. Speaker, you were also my teacher. And you may recall, had we in our day received a great mind, I don't think we would be speaking terms now, Mr. Speaker, because the number of things too are the reverse. I mean, a great one was something to celebrate with, and a great nine was something to avoid, Mr. Canada, who's in the mainstream.
Question number 334, the Honourable E.J. Phillips.
Mr. Speaker, can the government state what local needs there are for a bespoke postgraduate certificate in education and confirm the nature of the consultation that was conducted with the teachers and educators as part of the collaborative working between the University of Gibraltar and the Department of Education?
Answer, the Honourable Minister for the Environment, Energy, Climate Change and Education.
Mr. Speaker, firstly, the Department of Education works closely with the University of Gibraltar on a range of subjects which are of mutual interest, this being one of them. Further, the department, under the social partnership arrangement with the Gibraltar Teachers Association, keeps teachers informed of developments in education throughout and also endeavours to always consult teachers by engaging them in debate and affording opportunities for active discussion. Through supporting the university, we essentially want to become the gatekeepers into education by providing a single pathway into teaching and guaranteeing the quality of the product. Furthermore, we want to give mature students who perhaps have worked in different industries the opportunity to become teachers and enrich the lives of students who have experience elsewhere. We passionately believe this can only be good for Gibraltar.
Question number 335, the Honourable Ms. MD Desanian.
What is the government's position with regard to the Department of Education debt with the UK student loan company since I uncovered this debt several months ago?
Answer, the Honourable Minister for the Environment, Energy, Climate Change and Education.
Mr. Speaker, the Department of Education has no debt with the student loan company. The department pays the company on behalf of the students for loans made to the students themselves. Government position remains unchanged. It is fully committed to repaying all student loans awarded by the SLC in respect of university tuition fees prior to 2010-2011. In fact, government position is clearer than ever, given that during the past financial year, significant inroads have been made to establish student payment thresholds and guide students through the yearly overseas assessment process to prevent accumulation of arrears. The Honourable Member should note that this student debt was created by the previous administration and not the present government. The FSC did not uncover the debt, given the arrangement was entered into by the party of which he was once a member.
Mr. Speaker, I'm well aware of this story because I uncovered it to the point that no one on the opposite side knew about it until I said it, and I was actually told it wasn't there until a few days later I was told that I was in fact right, and there was a debt. And even though perhaps technically the debt belongs to the student, I think we all know that this was, yes, a mechanism, perhaps from the previous administration, but that effectively falls on the Department of Education's lap. So I think the Honourable Gentleman knows where I'm coming from, what I'm trying to get to, and the basic answer I want is to know that there is a backlog, and when will it be paid, because there are students who are still receiving demands to be paid, and I believe that it's the Department of Education that has to settle this debt. And if I may just say, to give comfort, at least to the students, when will these levies stop and when will this matter be resolved?
No, Mr. Speaker, it doesn't even like that at all, Mr. Speaker. The loans are given to the students. If the students are in any difficulty whatsoever, all they have to do is contact the Department of Education. Mr. Speaker, I can say that funds are awarded on a yearly basis to the level of around £600,000 in order to pay these debts. In fact, the outstanding amount at the moment is that if there's £400,000 less than it was 6 months ago, so this is regularly being paid. The Education Department has been paying monthly installments of £50 per student, grinding in the sense that unless the student comes to the department and says, this is the repayment that I have, then the department has no idea of how much it is. The problem has been that the student loan company was not prepared to give the Department of Education information on individual debt to individual students. One can understand that. So what has happened over the past year or so is that we have obtained consent to share status from the students, and the department has painstakingly made sure that they contacted all the students, and finally we've been able to achieve that. So we are now able to ask the student loan company for that information. There is another difficulty in that the information now is paperless, and so the student has to personally log onto the account. It's not a question of sending a bill through. But I can say, Mr. Speaker, that we are making the progress that is expected. There is nobody who is in any difficulty whatsoever. The number of students today who still owe money is about 40 or so less than 6 months ago. So we're regularly doing this. And we offer all sorts of facilities, Mr. Speaker. Students, for example, who remain in the UK, they are tracked and identified and placed on deductions of earnings from the salary. And then if those students send us their paychecks, then we will reimburse them directly, because those are deducted in the UK directly to the student loan company. And moreover, students who have settled in the UK and have difficulties with their credit rating and they, in applying for mortgages and so on, if they apply to the Department of Education with the information, the department will pay off all the loans. So there is no difficulty, but certainly if there is some exchange between the loan company and the student that the department isn't aware of, then a payment cannot be made. But the doors are open and there is no difficulty. And I can say absolutely that no student and no parent, no family should at all be concerned. If they have any difficulty whatsoever, they can get in touch with the department or with myself personally, and we will sort it out.
Mr. Speaker, I just want to step into the question in relation to this point. I have been in a room when one of the students in particular, just 3 weeks ago, was contacted by the student loan company. This is the first call that they had received in many weeks relating to the student loan debt. And the person got quite distressed by the fact that this company had been calling them on a regular basis to ask them about the debt and the fact that they had to pay it. and that they had no luck with the government of Gibraltar securing funds of that debt. I've been in the room when this has happened with telephone calls from the students, so obviously I'm telling you from what I've heard myself. No, I'm not saying that. It's the difficulty that we've got to realise that the difficulty is being faced by students who are in full-time employment that are being faced by this company. And although I understand that there is this consent deferred, which is a useful mechanism in order for the government to contact directly and discuss individual debts with a student loan company, what I'm seeing on the ground and the reports I'm receiving in the first hand knowledge that I have been hearing is discussing with student loan companies for this particular form of student, this is 2009-2010 student, is that it is becoming quite distressing and the challenge that is being presented there. I understand that this individual has contact with Bartlett because there's been no luck in respect of that particular debt. But I only offer that as information to the minister so that access that can be taken.
I can categorically say that no student needs to be worried, and if they have that kind of call, they should contact them. It is very possible that a desk officer in a student loan company generates this information out of their computer and they make a phone call. This has happened before in other scenarios. It happened, I remember, to doctors who were getting calls from the General Medical Council about an issue that we at a high level had resolved, but the desk officers weren't aware. And we will take this up, and if that student wants to get in touch, we will take that case directly. There is now a more recent option now to enter into a power of attorney, which would allow greater flexibility, and if students want to enter into this arrangement, again, those doors are open. But nobody should be worried, absolutely nobody, and anybody is, they know where my office is, and we're very, very happy to accommodate all of them.
Mr. Speaker, when we asked the Minister whether he's aware, or he may be aware, of a press release issued by the UK Department of Education, which then Treasury student loans on the 6th of February this year, talking about the process of selling part of the English student loan book, which will affect the student loan company. And this may explain the sudden, or appear to be a sudden, perseverance of student loan companies in posting these loans. I look at the notes to editor that I can give them the page entry is not worthy. Unlike in previous sales, the income contingent loans included in this sale will continue to be collected by HRC1FC, the student loan companies, and it says the sale involves securitizing the remaining future repayments on the loans and selling securities representing the rights. To these to range of purchases, sale process expected to take several months, etc., etc. So it may be that the government needs to review its position and perhaps consider the financial implication that we're settling all these loans at once, because there's evidence that the UK government itself is in the process of repackaging these loans and throwing off the third parties.
Mr. Speaker, the government is exploring that possibility.
Question number 336, the Honourable Ms. M.D. Saman.
Regarding the new schools that government has promised to build in this electoral term, can the Minister for Education confirm that no public land is being sold off to fund them?
Answer, the Honourable Minister for the Environment, Energy, Climate Change and Education.
The big arrangements for the funding of any schools will be detailed when the relevant projects are announced.
Can I ask the Minister how long that will take, considering there's 2 years left to build these 5 schools?
A couple of weeks, perhaps, Mr. Speaker, there might even be surprises next week.
We now move to question 385. These are covered in the supplemental. Note these questions which were circulated this afternoon. We'll start with question number 385, the Honourable Alex Young.
Mr. Speaker, since Chinese President spoke in each calendar year, how many applications to become employed by the support employment company have been all accepted through the trial or still remain pending in the decision?
Answer, the Honourable Minister for Economic Development, Telecommunications and Existence.
I will answer this question together with 386 and 387.
Question number 386, the Honourable Ellis Lemon.
So the Speaker, can the government say how many employees of the supported employment company are currently working within the public sector or government and companies, and how many are working in the private sector?
Question number 387, the Honourable Ellis Lemon.
So the Speaker, what inroads have been made in relation to public sector and other supported employment models?
Answer, the Honourable Minister for Economic Development, Telecommunications and Education.
Mr. Speaker, there are no applications in the support of employment company made, accepted, declined, or remaining pending in the system since January 2012 for any calendar year, as I have previously explained in Parliament. As of the end of September, the supported employment company had 32 employees placed in the public sector and 36 employees placed in the private sector. I refer the Honourable Member to my previous answer on public sector. I am not sure what he means by inroads in relation to public sector, but to date, to my knowledge, there has been no further development of public sector or other supported intensive models. As initially announced, introduced, this entails affording young people with special needs career pathways such that they feel supported and empowered to do well and progress with their life and careers. At the moment, there is a learning support assistant, LSA, seconded to the Education Department. The current role is simply to identify potential school leavers with special educational needs and afford them guidance and support as they make the transition from school to full-time employment. Students are given the opportunity to participate in short-term work placement. This consists of either one full or half-day period over 6 weeks. The student still remains at school for the remainder of the time.
Speaker, could I just clarify? I have heard of people who have tried to approach the government with a view of getting an employment for the children. And there doesn't seem to be an actual assistance and a mechanism whereby you don't feel like an actual application, but you leave your details. But it doesn't seem that people are getting answers whether they can be accepted into the company as an employee or not. So it seems to me that at least I know two people who are wishing to seek if there is a possibility of becoming employed by tech, but they're not getting anywhere. So I can't deduce from the answer that the Honourable Minister has given me whether there are any pending decisions to be made, given that it doesn't seem to be a very formal process in order to get it set.
I know the Honourable Member was not here when we started on this. The petition work that initially on the 1st of February 2012, within the number of people that were on the BTS scheme, some 40 were identified as persons who had learning disability problems and therefore it was considered by the people who had been running the scheme under the previous government would be people who would have great difficulty in finding work in the private sector or in the public sector on a competitive basis. They were initially transferred to the employment training company together with the other 200 or however many workers there were at that point in time. And once people started moving out of the employment training company into normal jobs in the private sector, those that have been identified for us were, in fact, transferred to the newly created company, supported employment company, where they got investment centers, as I explained to him the people that we monitor to send to normal employers, if we find that really there is no way that we can actually get them into the normal market, then the decision is taken that they will come in and they are given a 20-hour slot within the supported employment and a contract. But that only happens not because they make an application and not because the application is refused, but because we actually process almost everyone that goes into the employment market unless they come in basically passing through. There are a number of people who come into the employment service, register, and get out on the same day because they come with a contract of employment in one hand and the registration in the other. But anybody else that is there more than 24 hours gets referred to the training program to see if we can either through assisting the wages or in some other form persuade somebody in the private sector to take the candidate of the ETB in preference to a candidate from outside. Anybody with disabilities is treated the same as anybody without disabilities in that system. And only when we come to the conclusion that it is not going to be possible to do what we think is necessary, but assume that they will enjoy a normal job in a normal employer, do we then give them the offer of coming into the sector? Anybody who has not had that offer is because they're still trying to get them on their job.
Question number 388, the Honourable Aaron Clinton.
Mr. Speaker, I refer to question 299 of 2017. Can the government confirm whether it or any of its owned companies has entered into a contractual agreement with Gibraltar Capital Assets Limited to pay for its housing allowance? And if so, which government owned company is liable for the payment?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Economic Development, Telecommunications and the GSP.
Speaker, I will answer the question with 389 and 390.
Question number 389, the Honourable Aaron Clinton.
Mr. Speaker, can the government please advise why Gibraltar Land Holdings Limited sold the East Side Reclamation site to GAR or GAR Limited, another government-owned company, on the 22nd of May 2014 for £75,469,680, and how much penalties is paid to the government on this transaction?
Question number 390, the Honourable RMP.
Speaker, can the government advise if GAR Limited has been granted any loans by Gibraltar Investment Holdings Limited, and if so, what amount is outstanding at the 31st of December 2016?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Economic Development, Telecommunications and the GSP.
Speaker, the amount of stamp duty paid on the concession regarding the East Side was £2,647,082. And the concession took place because the government decided that it should, in the context of the negotiations for the development that were then taking place. Prior to the answer to question 299 of 17, the position has not changed. The Honourable Member has been told many times, and those of his colleagues who were here before him even more time, that the company cash balances are collectively pulled and managed by the Treasury following the model created by the GSD administration when they were in government. As regards to the extension of an agreement, my understanding is that the relevant company is a residential property company. But this has to be understood in the context that I've just explained to him again about regarding the common pool for cash balances.
Speaker, welcome to the Minister as well. So back to question 299. I have a hand card from last on the discussion or not. He said he would go away and come back and let me know if he could. Am I correct in saying that the company that has an agreement with Gibraltar Capital Assets Limited is Gibraltar Residential Property Company Limited? GRP?
I understand that.
Does the Minister have any detail as to the nature of this agreement and the term of the agreement?
Oh, I don't have the details, but I advise the Honourable Member would not bother to ask me because if I had them, I wouldn't provide them.
Okay.
Mr. Speaker, I thank the Minister. At least we have a name that we're confident this is more than we had before. If I may turn to question 390, I believe he's given the easiest spot answer of the cash pool of the company, but then I actually answered the question whether Garland has been granted any loans. Could you elaborate on that?
Yes, Mr. Speaker, the cash pool is accessible to everybody in their companies, and therefore they either put money in the pool or take money out of the pool as and when they require it. We've got a written answer on loans to companies, and we will see that written answer with the explanation.
I'm grateful to Mr. Robert, I look forward to that tribute. In terms of the sale and lease side reclamation to Jar Limited, I can explain what the economic rationale for that transaction was other than it had begun.
Well, Mr. Speaker, we had a debate on this point on countless occasions. The government takes policy decisions, which is the job that the government has to do in dealing with situations with investors and with anybody else. Those decisions might not be the ones that the honourable member might take if he was faced with the responsibility of taking it. But the government takes a decision that it thinks is necessary, and if the government had to satisfy the honourable member or justify itself to the honourable member for every decision, in effect, he would be replacing the Queen, as I hope of course.
Mr. Speaker, I'm flattered by that remark, but I would never dream of speaking about this. But clearly, the Minister must recognise that in incurring a stamp duty liability of 2.6 million, there must be a very real economic reason for doing this, and I know there must be, because I know he, as a very long standing economist, wouldn't accept any transaction that didn't provide some economic value. Is there any concern in this house as to why is this put the government in a better negotiating position? This is not well noticed, but it's not that the company is paying money that belongs to the state to a different party. It is a state-owned company coming to the state. The money that is paid is not in the account of the company, but it is in the account of the government. That's what the state, the stamp duty is being paid by a government-owned company to the government. There is no economic cost involved, because the government originally owned a company with £2 million and didn't have in the consolidated fund the £2 million, and now the government has got £2 million in the consolidated fund, and the company doesn't have it in its account. So the economic effect is zero. The reality of it is that at one stage, the government decided to make property constituents of the government liable to stamp duty and a number of other things. As when they were running out of borrowing capacity. I've explained this in connection with some of the other changes that took place in the accounting system, where we got a number of duplication of things that come in and out. For example, the fact that we have a situation where contributions from the social insurance, which never used to go through a consolidated fund, now go through a consolidated fund and come out of the consolidated fund, was because before the government offered the threshold for loans, they were hitting the loan ceiling on the 80%. And instead of tackling the 80% like we have done and accepting that the 80% is in fact a limitation on the borrowing ability of the government, which is a scandal because the growth of the GDP by definition will always be faster than the growth of the government revenue. So
80% of government revenue will always produce a lower debt than 40% of GDP. So, for example, a number of things were done, like paying rent on property to itself, paying some duty on property to itself, which in effect, doing the, what I just told the honourable member with the authorities of the agency, which previously used to get income in directly, and now they get money coming in into the consolidated fund. With the book that he has, he will see that the book shows money coming into an agency which was collected by the government on behalf of the agency. Well, the collection of the government on behalf of the agency meant the retirement revenue higher. If the money had been collected by the agency without passage to the government, the retirement revenue would have been lower. Every pound that went through that system made possible another 80p worth of debt. So that is how the system came about, which appears to him, looking at this particular transaction, as being a situation where an economic decision is being taken, when in fact the decision was taken originally to make something payable that would otherwise have been, it would have been possible to exempt from payment, simply because of the, and we've left the system as it was, which is frankly more hassle to try and change the book than to leave it as it is, because the effect really is that in economic terms, it's a paper exercise. It's money that goes in and goes out, but ultimately the collective wealth of the government is in the assets in the company and the assets in the government. In terms of the cash pool which was really invented when the government decided to have many trading companies which did not exist in 2008, in 1996, they had no employees and only had assets. When they started trading, in effect what the government did was, to some extent, create for the companies the equivalent of what has existed since time immemorial, in that there is an ability to have deposits and advances in public sector entities. And therefore, all those deposits and advances only get cleared when you close the accounts on the 31st of March. But in between the 1st of April and 31st of March, the money can go in one direction or the other, and this is used as part of the mechanism that the Treasury has for the flexibility of meeting liabilities in one corner of the empire when there are money available sitting in another corner. That's really the best way that I can paint the picture, you know, part of which will be things that have got the honourable members are familiar with, and I happen to be there because I've been seeing the changes happening over a long period of time.
Mr. Speaker, I'm extremely grateful to the Minister for explanation. And maybe you can correct me if I'm wrong or in the statement, but effectively, in terms of sanctions, it's a zero sum game in that it just goes down from the left pocket against the right pocket. But the sanctions will be shown as revenue in the consolidated fund, and the liability would technically remain with the company. Would you accept that as correct?
But technically, as a paper exercise, that is correct. The owner of a company is the owner of a pocket where the money is.
Question number 391, the Honourable E.J. Phillips.
Can the Minister for Training provide details of how many trainees have completed their MVP course for the training scheme run in partnership with GivDoc and when that training was completed?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Economic Development, Telecommunications and the GST.
Mr. Speaker, I will answer this question together with questions 392 to 394.
Question number 392, the Honourable E.J. Phillips.
Can the government explain why the GivDoc partnership trainees have still not received their accredited certificates?
Question number 393, the Honourable E.J. Phillips.
Can the government state the total cost to the taxpayer of the future job strategy since inception?
Question 394, the Honourable E.J. Phillips.
Can the government state 1. Total number of people who started on the future job strategy and of those people 2. And the full-time employment.
answer the Honourable Minister for Economic Development, Telecommunications and the GST.
Mr. Speaker, the number of trainees who have completed their MBQ courses with the training scheme running partnership with Bitbet by year of completion is as follows. 1999-15, 2016, 2001-11, 2002-10, 2003-12, 2004-7, 2005-14, 2006-13, 2007-13, 2008-11, 2009-14, 2010-15, 2011-15, 2012-16, 2013-7, 2014-6, 2015-29, 2016-12. Any apprentices that have not yet received the certificate have not done so because all the necessary procedures have not yet been completed. The government rejects the Honourable Member's philosophy that providing training for employment is a cost to the taxpayer. The government considers it an investment in creating a pool of skills which benefits the individual and potentially assists economic growth. The amount invested in providing training and related infrastructure is already known to the Honourable Member opposite and was identified by the Leader of the Opposition in 2011 election campaign as £11 million a year. For reason for this, for an amount of this order has been made in every budget and approved by Parliament. The expenditure in support of training for employment under the future job strategy continues at this annual level, and the concerns of members opposite in the past that it would have to be increased over the years has not materialized. It is currently at the same level and is expected to continue at under £1 million a month to the financial year 2019-20. The number of persons who benefited from starting on the future job strategy training program to April 2017 has been 2,806. And of these, 1,859 obtained employment at the end of the training period.
Insofar as the future job strategy is concerned, I'm not going to recite our views in relation to that. They're well known, and I disagree with the Honourable Gentleman's respect to his analysis of what we say the costs were. But it's quite clear from the figures that the Honourable Minister has deployed as of up to April 2017 that 2,802 people have engaged in the future job strategy. And of those, he says that 1,859 of those have secured full-time employment. There's a significant number of just under 5,000 people that have not been guaranteed a placement pursuant to the government's commitment to guarantee everyone a bit.
Mr. Speaker, the people who completed the training got employment. Not everybody completes the scheme. I mean, some people give up and they do MBQ level 1 and then before they finish the MBQ level 1. Let me remind the Honourable Member that in 2012, the Leader of the Opposition asked me in December of 2012 how many, what was the percentage of the number of people who had completed and got a job, and it was 28%. And he then told me that what we were doing was clearly no better than what was there before under the GSD, because the GSD had a 28% success rate. Well, I pointed out to the Leader of the Opposition then, and the other one that was here, that the 28% in the first year was in fact because it was the first year. And in that, in those people that we were taking on in the training companies initially, were included all the people who were in the VTS. And for those people, we did not have a job guarantee before they entered. Where people had to be recycled because they were placed with employers who told us at the time, I told it in 2012 when we took over, that there were people who were saying, well, look, I didn't really need somebody in my business, and I've already, I'm having all a business that is big enough to take on another employee. But as far as I was concerned, I was willing to take on somebody into the business as long as it didn't cost me anything, in order to give that person an opportunity maybe to learn some skills and go back to the unemployment list and get a job. Because that is all that the government was asking of me. But if you're telling me that if I keep him, I have to then give him a job, then take him back, I don't want him. That meant that we had to move people out. Initially, we moved them into the public sector in many areas simply because they didn't have enough places in the private, but they were all eventually found places in the private sector. And when that happened, since there is a thing called a contract between the placement provider and the training company, on the basis that after the first month of probation, any further training that goes into the job is on the basis that the person has got 1 month, the employer has got 1 month to decide whether he thinks the candidate is going to be suitable or not. Then, if they carry on with the trainee for 5 or 6 or 7 or 8 months, and then they turn around at the end of the 9 months and say, well, I don't want to keep him, then they have to refund the 9 months. That's how the scheme has been working. Once that scheme started taking people fresh from the unemployment list and not having to deal with the people we had at the beginning, the success rate was beginning to go up. And in fact, I think at the rate that it is there, it's something like 62 or 63%, or something like that. I'm not really sure. I don't know what the percentage, but I know that it's been consistently over the years in between 65% and 70%, depending. I mean, sometimes we've got better months in terms of retaining trainees. Sometimes the trainees decide themselves to resign. Well, look, there's nothing we can do about that. Sometimes people are training to do something. For example, I can tell you, I remember we got some apprentices that in the middle of the apprenticeship have seen vacancies coming out in the public sector and decide to abandon the apprenticeship and go to the public sector to get the job, even though the job in the public sector might be one that is less skilled than the one that is there, because the scheme from the beginning has only guaranteed employment in the private sector with the person of whom we are in partnership. The partnership agreement requires the commitment that the person would be employed. In the training that I explained to him not long ago of the bus drivers, the coach drivers for the tour operators, the agreement with the tour operators is that after we finish the training period, which are subsidizing, they take them on. So, the figure, obviously we would like to be able to achieve 100%, but, I think what we've been able to achieve until now is in the 60s. And in fact, when the leader of the union used to ask me the reason why people were falling out, it was invariably either people discontinuing themselves or people having to be terminated for disciplinary reasons. And it wasn't the fact that the employer was not at fault. There have been very few employers that have defaulted and they have to pay. And if I can come back to my training.
The Minister agreed with me that now is the time to revisit the viability and the sustainability of the future job strategy, given the, what can be estimated at £66 million of spending in respect to success rate that gravitates between 60% and 65%. Would the Minister agree that now is the time to revisit the viability of that moving forward?
The position is that we've got declining numbers of potential candidates because the levels of unemployment are much lower, and the number one of the employment survey isn't being tabled yet. I don't think that we see that the employment levels are higher. So there's more people working and less people unemployed. The throughput of people is lower now than it was at the beginning. We are in fact open to look at anything that is worth supporting in terms of the commitment that we've got. We decided in the election of 2011 that that was among the money we were going to commit to doing this. That commitment has been maintained. It's the only part of the budget really that hasn't grown, simply because the fact that the amount that we pay the trainees has gone up has been compensated by the fact that there are less people available to become trainees. So, you know, there are less people in the system. I mean, even though each person gets paid more now than they were getting 5 years ago, the total cost is still manageable within that budget, which pays for a number of other things more than just the wages. But certainly, we are prepared to revisit the scheme in the context of anything that anybody can put to us with result, not simply in people becoming more skilled and remaining unemployed, but more skilled with a clear opportunity to take up a job because the job exists and because we know the job exists. Because that is a commitment that has been from day one. We train for employment. We don't train to have very skilled unemployed people.
If you see that, may I bring the General Minister back to the reply he gave in respect to the question number 392? The Minister says that the training for him that received the appropriate certificate is because the process is ongoing or something. Could you, if you have any information, to expand that further, what is actually missing?
I think there were a small number of people who, having finished the preparation of the portfolio, the assessor that was employed left the center and, frankly, had not done some of the work that required doing, and there was a period when that work was being done, and until we, some time later, were able to recruit somebody that was a retired craftsman whom we've been able to get trained and qualified to be an assessor and accepted by the awarding body in the UK, and then have come in and done a catch-up exercise and some work. But there are people, for example, in those circumstances who are already craftsmen and already working as craftsmen, but still have not had the certificate, but I don't think anything else is required of them. It's a matter for the people in the training center to make sure that the paperwork is being done. We've just had somebody from City and Regis this last week looking at the procedures that are following and the infrastructure is there, and we've got a good report from him, and I think somebody from EAL is coming next week to do a similar exercise. But I think the difficulty has been is right a lot on the work that needs to be done in order to submit the report to the awarding body to get the awarding body to send it to the certificate.
Yes, because we have spoken in the past about an assessor no longer being in the training center. But I thought it was that safety margin because the assessors are subject to what's called internal verifier, of which we have consideration of that. So, the only thing that worries me to speak about that, I think I have questions with the Minister of the Regiment, is that a fair amount of time seems to have elapsed since the trainee completed the portfolio and therefore ceased to be a trainee. So, are we in any risk of too much period of time having elapsed and then the awarding body? When you send this ultimate, you're sending it very far because it comes like an overall oversight to the city when you send it. And do we run the risk of that? Because that's the same thing when I wrote to me, if I can please expedite the matter, because if you typically need to be able to arrive, you know, for so much work within, so much time and so much time and money, so if you say you see the whole to be left for the last minute.
So I think that the risk that the Honourable Member is explaining existed, from what I've been told, I do not understand the system as well as he does, but from what I've been told, but action was taken in conjunction with the people in the UK. And I am told that you know, everything is in place to their satisfaction, and that the people involved expect that before the end of this year, anybody that is without a certificate will get one. That is what I'm told.
I think I'm going to have to now adjourn until tomorrow at 3 p.m.